Imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal remembering South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who visited him in 2007 when he was still on death row. And that does it for our show. We continue our year-end conversations with National Book Award-winning poet Martina Spada on Wednesday, Noam Chomsky on Thursday, and on Friday we'll look back at 25 years of Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Berkey, Augusta Messiah Rhodes. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love. I'm Amy Goodman.
25 years, imagine that. It's 6 o'clock, and you're listening to WUSB in Stony Brook. It's a Tuesday, so that means it's time for Off the Wall. Off the Wall. And this is Emmanuel over here, and Kyle is over there.
Yeah, I'm with you. Would you like me to...
Like you to what?
Make an announcement.
Do you have an announcement to make?
No.
Well, then why would I want you to make an announcement?
No, I was just curious. How you doing?
I'm doing fine, so it's an inquiry, not an announcement.
Yeah.
I'm good. Well, okay... Good, maybe stretching it a bit. I don't know. How would you describe me, having seen me over the past day or so? Flustered?
Burdened.
Burdened. Yeah, burdened is definitely a word. Let me explain. First of all, I'll ask you, Kyle. Have you ever heard the term ambulatory EEG?
No.
Okay, well, I had never heard that either, and that is what I have right now. You might remember, on this very show, a bunch of months ago, I had one of my flashing light headache-type things where it's hard to remember things in the past for about 20 minutes or so, and it's, like, supposedly a common thing. I've had it several times over the years, I've always described it to my doctors. They say, yeah, that's a version of a migraine. No big deal. But the last time I described it, my doctor said, you know, just to be 100% sure, why don't you see a neurologist? So I said, okay, you know what? I'll do that at the end of the year, because my deductible, I met my deductible this year for the first time. Very proud of myself.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That is an accomplishment.
It is an accomplishment because it's so very high.
People aspire to that.
And I made it to the top this time. And I figured, okay, why not, go in for that appointment? Well, it turned out they like to do a lot of tests. I didn't know this at the time. Otherwise, I would have gone earlier because these tests are going to extend over the new year, apparently. But at least I'm getting this one in. And this one is the ambulatory EEG, which involves me wearing this electronic cap on my head for 3 days and having to walk around with this electronic gizmo on my side that is... Basically, it's like a backpack, except it's a side pack. I've got all these wires attached to my head. I've got this skull cap that makes me look like I'm some kind of prayer leader or something. And, you know, a white skull cap.
Well, it's like bandaged. No, it looks good.
And it gets crazier because then there's this laptop bag I have to carry, too, with a tablet in it and a camera that's supposed to be watching me at all times. And it's not watching me at all times, I'll tell you that right now. It'll watch me when I feel like it needs to watch me, but they really don't need that part of it. I think that's just for extreme cases. But the other thing is, when they were handing all this to me and installing all this, there is this button on the end of a wire that I'm supposed to press if I have some kind of an episode. Now, you know, imagine me walking into any establishment dressed this way with you know, a white cap on my head, a white cloth cap on my head, carrying all this baggage around me, wires attached to me, and holding a button on the end of a wire. I mean, for God's sake, you would not even have to ask questions to take action. And that's why I'm not doing very much right now, except, well, radio is safe. Radio from nowhere near the studio, because I'd probably make a lot of people very uncomfortable. But it has been a burden, because it's very hard to move. You don't want to unplug certain things, and you're always carrying this thing next to you. It's almost impossible to go to sleep. Occasionally you have to recharge, you have to plug into the wall. There's that. But, you know, with all that said, I'm going to just try and act normal. I know it must be hard looking at me in this particular state. But it's the way what they do is they measure your brain waves for 3 days. And, now I saw them when they first plugged it in. There's about 10 windows or 10 measurements going on at the same time. And, it'll be interesting to see what they discover about my brain. But again, this is just because my doctor said, yeah, just to be safe, do this. So, okay, great. And, you know, from the appointment I had an appointment last week where they gave me a memory test, the thing that Trump took, you know, where you have to say a bunch of words and then say them back and memorize the words, or just say, was this word in that group or not? And then there's all kinds of electronic things where you match letters to numbers and move things around. And then they have you sit in the room for an hour and 10 minutes or so with something else wired to your head and all kinds of gel that gets stuck in your hair. And I looked at my insurance company, and we're flirting with $10,000 already just for that, not even counting what I'm doing right now. So it's pretty amazing, and of course because I'm at my deductible, I can do this. But next week it's gonna be a different story if they have more tests that they want to do. But it's weird, they did this without really anything other than me describing the same symptoms I've described in the past, and been told that, hey, that's nothing really to worry about. This is just to be safe, and I'm fine with it. Why not? Why not get these tests done? And everyone should have the same kind of health care that the President of the United States gets. You should be able to get a chest x-ray and do the stress test and have your head examined literally and whatever else. You ever notice ex-presidents, they live to be 100 because they get good health care. That's one of the reasons, at least. So, yeah, that's me this week.
Great stuff. I hope that you find what you're looking for, and it's good that you're establishing a sort of a baseline of all this logging.
Yeah, it's something. It really is. But that's not the focus of the show.
Looks like you're connected to some sort of super mainframe.
Well, you know, it would be nice if I could just wire myself into the board here. I am a USB device right now, believe it or not.
Yes.
I have a USB plug on me that I can plug in.
Become a conduit through you.
I don't dare plug into anything other than the thing they gave me. I don't know what's going to happen if I plug into my own computer. So I'm not going to try. I'm a hacker, but I'm not, you know, going to experiment that much. Because, you know, the worst thing is having to do this again. I don't want to do that. All right, so, ambulatory EEG, look it up. It's a ton of fun. And if you're very lucky, you'll get to do it someday. I've never seen anybody walking around like this, but there must be people doing it, you know?
The technology is probably emerging and developing constantly like so many other things, so I'm guessing that it's just going to get more comprehensive and thorough and smaller and hopefully less of an encumbrance, but this is certainly takes the cake for anything I've seen as far as testing.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, let's look at what's been going on in the world. Did you see this tweet yesterday?
No.
Well, I didn't even say who it was from.
Oh, you're
so
right.
So you saw no tweets yesterday is the only conclusion I can reach.
I'm not even sure that's true. I might have seen a couple.
Well, then you just lied by saying no, because I said, did you see the tweet? And you said no immediately.
You said this tweet.
Well, yeah, this tweet. I've isolated one tweet, and...
Yeah, and as far as I knew, said no already. Based on the information so far, no. I mean, I just wanted to, you know, be there in the conversation here. But you know what? Let me finish. Let me finish so you can finish.
What are you finishing? I'm the one that wanted to quote a tweet. You wonder why our shows end so quickly.
What's the tweet?
Oh, my God. this is from one Senator Rand Paul. Perhaps you've heard of him.
Yeah.
Look up the term jerk face on Wikipedia and other related phrases, and you'll see his picture.
What's it about?
Okay, he basically said this, how to steal an election, and then the rest is in quotes. And I want you to pay attention to this, Carl. How to steal an election.
Okay.
Seeding an area heavy with potential Democratic votes with as many absentee ballots as possible, targeting and convincing potential voters to complete them in a legally valid way, and then harvesting and counting the results.
That sounds like just voting.
That is voting. That is what an election is supposed to be.
They're trying to make something that's legal and normal sound like the boogeyman, like super scary.
But it is to them, and this is the point. To Republicans, any election is scary. Because, as we've said, when more people vote, Republicans lose. So this is why they don't want people to be able to vote easily. This is why they don't want mail-in ballots. Because more people will vote. When more people vote, Republicans lose. I just can't believe that he would say something like this in a public forum that is so easy to expose for what it is. And boy, if you look at the comments that follow, nobody's buying this. And this might actually be a great argument for more pushing towards voter reform and empowering voters.
Yeah, what a pseudo-intellectual pile of contrarian, fog, just to stir up this kind of culture of being against anything or believing anything in favor of being against something else. Whatever. No, even if it is paradoxical or contrary or contradictory and so forth, it just it's so repulsive. I don't have a. I mean, it's sad to give it as much time, but it's what is happening left and right all over.
Mostly right.
Oh.
But
we see it so many places.
Yeah, it's just. It does deserve attention because people need to see this is how they think. This is what they view as the threat. The threat is people being empowered enough to vote. And to actually say publicly that you believe that when Democrats are able to vote using mail-in ballots and absentee ballots, which, by the way, are the same thing, that is cheating. That is stealing an election somehow. Now, the only thieves here are the ones who are clinging to power when they represent a minority view. It's so wrong, and I really hope that we're strong enough as a nation, as a system, to kick them out and start actually getting things done. It's so very sad.
It's an enormous mess. There are so many aspects of this we could... just diverge on one topic after another. I find that is the new attitude, though, of pseudo-intellectualism, that, like, if we can deny and create a false narrative and believe it in this collective psychosis, it's somehow, especially if it's questioning everything, if you're not questioning everything, you don't have this sort of pseudo-intellectual cover that is being used as a vehicle to advance really, really unintelligent stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, that there's just flat wrong that only serves to, as you said, continue that party's grip.
One tweet. That was the tweet of the day, I think. Okay, moving on. When I say Southampton, Kyle, what do you think of?
I don't know, like water, maritime.
And that works for either Southampton, so not sure which one you're referring to.
Like,
you say.
Yeah, like boats.
Boats, again, yeah. Which Southampton?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You're not going to tell me.
And the Cunard Line, yeah. Large
okay,
ship.
So you're in Southampton, UK.
And
that's incorrect, because I'm referring
team.
To South. No, I'm referring to Southampton and Suffolk County. Now, when I say that, what do you think of?
Decadence.
Southampton?
Yeah.
There are literally signs in the street saying people have to be properly attired to walk in the street. That's true. Go to Southampton and look it up.
Well, it could be on the other side of, you know, town, too, where mm-hmm. it's like you're resenting it
okay.
in its proximity.
Last chance, just quickly. One.
I don't know anything about it. It's like blink and you miss it.
Well,
it's kind of forgettable.
You're referring to the village of Southampton, and we will be fielding all kinds of letters from them now that you've insulted them. I'm referring to the town of Southampton, which encompasses a bigger area.
Corruption.
Yes, okay. Well, you wouldn't be wrong on that. But no, marijuana sales will be legal within Southampton town after officials declined to opt out of allowing retail and consumption establishments before the state's year-end deadline. That was a very clumsy sentence, but basically they're not opting out. They're opting in. Supervisor Jay Schneiderman has repeatedly said if Southampton were to opt out of pot sales, marijuana would still be available for sale within the township on the Shinnecock Indian Reservation, but the town would not get the tax revenue. Yeah, that's why he's the supervisor, because he figures things like this out. The tribe has publicly said it will move forward with recreational sales. In fact, that could be starting any day now. Schneiderman estimates sales will bring in $1 to $2 million in tax revenue annually for the town. It wasn't clear to me that we were opting out of anything other than the money that could be used to address mental health issues or drug addiction. And that's something that the towns of Smithtown and Huntington and Islip, I believe, should keep in mind, because they have opted out. Brookhaven has not, and we are in Brookhaven, so we're quite happy about that. But opting out is just so short-sighted and ignorant, because, as he said, it will still be available, it'll still be legal. You just will not be getting any benefit from it as far as running dispensaries. And if you do some research and maybe visit a dispensary or two in those places where they are operating now, such as Massachusetts or Illinois or Washington or so many places, you will see that these are very professionally run, clean, intelligent establishments. And basically, if you vote not to have them, you're voting for the black market. You're voting to have illegal drug sales instead of legal drug sales. And I hesitate to even use the word drug, because marijuana is while it is a drug, it's not what you think of when you say selling drugs. You know, it's like going to a drugstore, I guess. Although those drugs are probably a lot more strong than marijuana is. I'm going down a road here. But basically, this is good news. I think this is something that the rest of the towns will see. It might take a year or two, but what this does, it gives Brookhaven, it gives Southampton, it gives Babylon the opportunity to show the rest of the island how it's done. And I look forward to that in the next year, because that's what 2022 is going to be.
Yeah, and soon they will be able to get flush toilets out there and all kinds of new infrastructure.
Well, how about this? If we get all this money in Brookhaven Town from dispensaries, why don't we use that money to build something that we wouldn't have built ordinarily and just say, look, that's what that money did for us, rather than just throw it into the pool where nobody knows, you know, what it went for or where it came from. But if you actually have something, you know, not a statue or something stupid like that, something that we need, but you can say that was paid for by pot money. That was paid for from opting in and moving forward. I think maybe the message will be seen then. And the message might be seen in other states where legalization is far in the distance, or so it appears.
Yeah, I think there's so many good ideas there. And you don't really know until you take it on as a project. And these localities, I mean, in seriousness, have every bit as much creativity and knowledge of what it might take. And they can tap so many different people in their community that can make sure that whatever and however they go about this stuff is done with you know, a lot of thought and respect for their locality and, you know, what works best for everyone there, and can innovate and bring something unique and maybe even create a market that's really sought after, just like we have, you know, wine districts, you know, and mm-hmm. vineyards, and, you know, people are drawn to these areas. So that's, I mean, that's just, in seriousness, really encouraging, well, and there's just so much there. But if people are barred from it, they're not going to think creatively about how to make use of that.
And the wine district you bring up is a very good analogy. And I would say that when you go, when you're a connoisseur of wine, you have the kind of conversation with people about the quality of the wine, how it's grown, et cetera. That you have in dispensaries. The difference is that if you consume a bunch of wine, you become unsafe to do a lot of things. You become more prone to doing violent things, for instance. That's what alcohol does. Yet we don't think twice about having a wine district, a whole district for wine on the North Fork. And marijuana is nothing like that. And it's basically being maligned as something worse than your neighborhood bar, which is simply not the case. Are there hazards? Yes, there are hazards, of course, as with almost anything. But having a program where it's legal.
I think, yeah, having an option for stressed out Americans who work too hard and, yeah, maybe should drink less as is,
mm-hmm.
and mix it up a little bit in their recreation. And I think there's a lot of healing that needs to go on.
When's the last time you saw a brawl amongst people that had smoked marijuana? That doesn't happen. You know, people don't, but people who drink a lot, they you know, get aggressive. It's very different. You don't think twice. Opening up another bar on Main Street, yeah, nobody even cares. But this, all of a sudden, it gets all the scrutiny. It's really not fair. So anyway, the towns of East Hampton, Hempstead, Oyster Bay, Huntington, Islip, Shelter Island, North Hempstead, and Smithtown have all opted out. Riverhead has opted in. Brookhaven has opted in. Babylon has opted in. And now Southampton has opted in. So it's going to be interesting. And there are some villages, too, that have opted out. But the deal is you have to opt out by this Friday, December 31st, or you're in. And once you're in, you can't get out. You can't opt out after you're in. Once you're out, you can opt in. And then once you opt in, you can't opt out again. But nobody anywhere in the country has ever opted in and then wanted to opt out. And I think that's very significant.
I believe this. I like this state. I like this strategy. It's forcing the issue, forcing a decision. Otherwise, you're going to be participating in a state program that has a lot of momentum and enthusiasm behind it right now. So that's actually a great story. So we'll follow that, and I think no doubt be discussing more, maybe even curating a cannabis show here on the airwaves of WUSB in Stony Brook.
Well, that's a good idea. I know there's a lot of people on WUSB who have who are aware of marijuana. How about that? They could be experts on this.
There are in music, mm-hmm. in the music industry, of course, and radio is that in extreme proximity to musicians and clubs and real culture and fun and vibrance in the community. So no doubt, yeah, there's plenty of DJs that would be able to comment on the intersection, the confluence of these different activities and culture. And, of course, music goes quite well with the healing properties of cannabis, and I dare say heals as well. So, yeah, I would stay tuned to WUSB. Surely we'll be putting together some incredible shows and specials on this emerging area of interest.
I want to steer back to jerk faces because we were talking about them earlier. You hear about this guy in the state of Oregon who was on a phone call with President Biden, some kind of Christmas Eve call. They took calls from the North American Aerospace Defense Command Santa Tracker, which each year purports to follow the progress of Santa and his reindeer. You know, I always mean to watch that and see just where they go, but whatever.
It's a little excruciating to...
It's a traditional duty for American presidents, and Donald Trump almost ruined the whole thing when he told a 7-year-old in 2018 that belief in Santa Claus is marginal at that age. Wow. Anyway, basically, somehow this father from Oregon was on the phone, and before hanging up, he said, "Let's go, Brandon." And we can't say what "Let's go, Brandon" is code for on the radio, but somehow it's become acceptable in the Trump camp for them to basically put say what it really stands for on signs and shout it in the street. It's it's an obscenity, in other words.
Oh, the terrorists? That's their slogan?
The Republicans. Let's not marginalize them any more than they already are marginalized. So this guy thought it would be funny to do that. Now, okay, in fairness, the guy has apologized. He says, "At the end of the day, I have nothing against Mr. Biden, but I am frustrated because I think he can be doing a better job. I mean, no disrespect to him." When he said this, he said, "Merry Christmas, let's go, Brandon." And Biden said, "Let's go, Brandon, I agree," in good humor. And then he asked, are you in Oregon? And the guy had hung up by that point. Anyway, the story doesn't end there. I wish it did, because I can accept somebody saying, "Oh, I was just being an idiot. I didn't mean it, it's inappropriate." It's not at all the same thing as calling out Trump, because you're calling out Trump for things he was actually doing and saying. And here you're just calling out a guy because the other guy told you to, or you just don't like the fact that they're in power. The guy apologized, so, it's water under the bridge. Except somehow this guy, Jared Schmeck, should be Jared Schmuck, but whatever, Jared Schmeck, yesterday was on the Steve Bannon podcast. And he basically said, "Donald Trump is my president, and he should still be president right now." he basically said that the election was stolen. In fact, I think he said that directly. So true colors, they show pretty quickly. I don't know what the fake apology was all about then. This guy's complaining that everybody's criticizing him, that his name is in the headlines now. This is what happens when you do something incredibly stupid or disrespectful like this. And apparently you meant it, and apparently you don't want it to go away. Now there's talk of him even running for office, if you can believe that. And I can believe that. If you look at the kind of people that Republicans are running, yeah, I could definitely see that. Wow, you can't make this up.
Yes, them and their troll challengers. The terrorist trader goes on the terrorist trader clearinghouse to vent after fake apologizing for, more glory in reprehensible insurrectionist deniers of democracy. So, good for them.
All right, let's have a feel-good story, all right? This is the story of Davion Johnson, 11 years old. He saved two people's lives in a single day. In December, Davion lives in Muskogee, Oklahoma. Were we in Muskogee?
Was that yes.
That was one of the towns.
Yes.
Which one was that? That was the first one or the second one? The one with the train or the one with the Veterans Day people?
Believe it was the first.
Okay. So we went to this town. It was one of the places we stopped in, one of these small places we stopped in. So we know this area. We might have passed by Davion, and we might pass by the people he saved. He loves wrestling, basketball, remote-controlled cars, and Fortnite. He was honored by his community this month for saving the life of a fellow student who was choking and an older woman who was escaping a house fire, both on the same day, December 9th. Yeah, principal at a school said he's always willing to help, always just a friend to everyone. He said to me, I don't want everyone to pay attention to me. I kind of did what I was supposed to do. I don't think he actually internalized how important the feat was that he did. All Davion knows is that on the morning of December 9th, he was by the water fountain at school when he heard a seventh-grade boy whisper through gasps, I'm choking, I'm choking. The boy opened a water bottle with his mouth, and his cap slipped into his throat. Davion wrapped his arms around the student's abdomen and performed the Heimlich maneuver, a technique he had learned on YouTube. After being inspired by his uncle, Wendell Johnson, an emergency medical technician, Davion said he had wanted to be an emergency medical worker since he was six. Now watching the boy choke, he had a sense of what the job would require. He squeezed the boy's abdomen once. Nothing. Another squeeze. He was still grasping for air. And finally, on the third squeeze, the cap flew out. And when emergency medical workers arrived, Davion kept asking the boy if he was okay. He recovered, was fine the next day. His principal says he acts like he's about 80. He's definitely an old soul. His mom picked up her son, who she said was a bit shaken up. They had church service later that evening, so they went home, rested, and then got back on the road. And that's when number two was saved. It was about 5 p.m. when his mom spotted smoke coming from the house. I didn't think anything of it, but he was like, no, Mom, this is a house on fire. She turned the car around, and there it was, a small fire near the back of the house. There were cars outside. The screen door was shut. The people inside didn't seem to be aware that their house was on fire. Five people stepped outside, saw what was happening, and ran. A sixth person, however, was having trouble. She was older and using a walker. She wasn't moving fast enough, Davion said. So I've got to kind of help her get to her truck because everybody was leaving. They arrived at the woman's truck. The sun was setting. Church services would begin soon. So Davion said goodbye to the woman whom he didn't know and got into his mother's car. And that's when the fire trucks arrived. Okay. I said it was a feel-good story. It's also a tearjerker because he had seen this before when he was 8 years old. He watched his father entering a burning apartment complex in Muskogee to make sure everyone was safe. His father, William James Logan, was not a firefighter, but he had done the right thing that day. I look up to my dad, he said. And on August 19th, his dad died from COVID-19 at 52. Yeah. I'm sorry, Kyle, you didn't see that coming, but just an indication of the goodness and the tragedy that's taking place in this nation every day.
A sharp hairpin turn you took there at the end of that
story. Well, I didn't see it coming when I was reading the story, so I figured I'd put you through the same thing. But imagine that, you know, this young kid being able to do all this good after having something so horrible happen to him, being cheated out of his having his dad around. It's just... Folks, get your booster, get your vaccination. Please, take care of yourselves. This thing is real. It just annoys me so much. Like, you know, you hear the stories about these right-wing talk show hosts and how all of a sudden they get sick or they die. And sometimes you don't even know what they died of. They just disappear. And you're left wondering. If you are listening to somebody who is basically saying, don't pay attention to this, it's fake, It's not real. You know, use this concoction instead. And if they suddenly disappear and the station that they work for hasn't been sold, hasn't gone under a management change, odds are COVID took them because that is what is happening. 800,000 people plus. It's affecting everybody. And this latest variant, while so far at least not as severe as Delta, seems to be affecting a lot more people, and that's worrisome.
Yeah, worrisome, and way too much smugness around this. This virus and this pandemic. People that are getting immunizations are being cautious, and they're being ridiculed for that,
mm-hmm.
for trying to abide by, you know, what businesses are requesting and localities around.
I don't get what people have such a problem with. if we're told to stay in our homes and we can't leave our homes, yeah, I could see getting angry at that. We're trying to avoid that. We're trying to avoid that by the simple things, wearing masks inside stores where the ventilation isn't great and you're close to other people. Why are you fighting that? Why are you fighting the vaccine itself? You know, it's like you want the disease to stick around, or you're just trying to prove some political point and make somebody else weak, which is unforgivable when you're talking about people losing their lives.
And I want to go back and look at this, and there's a certain blindness to that, too, that really, really irks me. I mean, just that, yeah, it's disappears, and no accountability. Nobody wants to even broach the subject because it might challenge or confront a certain homeostasis that everybody's comfortable with, and that just it makes me really, really sad.
Yeah.
I think less of my fellow humanity. I really do, and I wish it was some other way. I just know that it's incredibly reckless and unforgivable,
mm-hmm.
and it's just it's moving so quickly that what do you even say? And I just feel like not enough consideration of the caution that has been spread in a lot of the PSAs and information that's been put around.
We have a history of forgetting when people have done something truly awful. George W. Bush, everything going on in Iraq, everything going on in Afghanistan can be traced back to his ignorant actions and the many people who empowered him to do that. Today, he's a nice guy. Yeah, better than Trump, but, he makes nice paintings. No, we can't forget these things. We should never forget these things. And Trump, what he did at the beginning of this pandemic, unforgivable. Hundreds of people died who would still be alive today, in all likelihood. There are no equivalencies. You can't say, oh, but look at this person, what they did. Nobody got it completely right. You can find fault with everybody who is in charge of anything. And that's because science is constantly changing. The virus is constantly changing. But willful ignorance, ignoring the facts, that is something that is a choice. And we can't forget that. Even, I know Trump is arguing for the booster now. He's being booed by his own people. Okay, he's saying the right thing now. Doesn't erase what happened in the past, and we can't just give him a pass on that. We can't just let that go. That is something that happened. Didn't only happen here. Happened in Brazil as well. Happened in India. Happened in many, many places where basically a lot of citizens were sacrificed.
Societal sabotage.
Mm. Yeah.
Willful sabotage of their own societies and around our very tiny connected Earth.
Oh, thank you. That's a great transition to our feature, Films of the Year That Was. In case you're late to the game, we've been doing this for a long time where Kyle and I watch a Academy Award-winning film from the beginning of the Academy Awards until the present. And we're getting closer and closer to the present. We're up to 2010. And which one are we going to start with, the foreign or the domestic?
The foreign film.
The foreign film.
In a Better World.
In a Better World. From Denmark.
Yes, Havnen is the Danish name, which translates to The Revenge.
Yeah, I don't get that.
Thriller.
Yeah. If it translates to revenge, how come we get In a Better World? How did that happen?
Yeah, we got to have it all friendly and chewable. I don't know.
Well, I read the director, though, preferred our translation. But if they preferred our translation, why didn't they just name it that in the first place?
I don't know.
I don't
these
know.
These are questions I have no answers for. But
no
it's by Anders Thomas Jensen and directed by Suzanne Beer.
Uh-huh.
Female director is worth noting there.
Can I just note as a side note that last week's domestic winner, The Hurt Locker, was the first time a female director won Best Film and Best Director, I believe.
That's
so
correct,
there's
yes.
Definitely history being made.
Yeah, women behind the lens and in the director's chair, as it were.
I like this film, this Danish film.
It's about a Swedish doctor working overseas in a refugee camp, and he comes home infrequently.
Yeah, it's either Sudan or some other part of Africa, but it just cuts to him occasionally dealing with the most horrendous of injuries and this horrible warlord.
Specifically, he's treating patients who are victims of a warlord.
And then he's back home. He's back home in Denmark dealing with his son.
That's right. Christian moved from London and...
Not Christian, that's the other guy. His son is Elias.
I'm sorry, yes Elias.
Know your Danish fictional families.
Yes. Elias and his friend, who is from a different kind of home, where he has a bit of a distant relationship.
Yeah, Christian has just moved back to Denmark from London, where his mother has just died of cancer, and he blames his father, who travels around a lot,
doing business,
for giving up on her at the end.
Right. And they're still working through that grief, clearly, and this is manifesting in very odd ways. This young guy is acting out, and Elias is, finds common friendship and camaraderie with him.
Well, Elias is
facing bullies.
Yeah, he's made fun of because he has braces. Remember this in school? You always made fun of the kid with braces because they had buck teeth or something, and they had all kinds of nicknames for him. And Christian, the brooding kid from London, who's actually Danish, he sees this and doesn't approve, doesn't like bullies, and stands up to them.
Yeah, and so it just so happens they form an alliance and become friends, basically against the bully and the bully's father specifically, who is a car mechanic.
Wait, that was the bully's father? Are you sure about that? I didn't get that they were related. I thought that was another bully.
My notes say the father of the other child, a mechanic.
Oh, I didn't get that at all.
Tells Anton not to touch his child and slaps Anton in the face. Remember when he visits him at the shop and he's giving the boys a lesson?
He's giving his, Christian and Elias.
Yes.
But I didn't know, okay, first of all, we skipped over a few things. The bully in school, Christian hit him with a bike lock in a bathroom. And basically...
A tire pump.
It was a tire pump. Okay, I'm sorry. Basically got him to stop being a bully, at least towards them. But almost got in trouble. He pulled a knife on him, too. But the two kids, Christian and Elias, lied about the knife, so they got away with that. So then, later in the film, Elias's father is taking him out for ice cream or something, and the younger brother of Elias gets into a fight in the playground. The father tries to pull them apart, and the father of the other kid... is this grown-up bully who slaps Elias's dad across the face.
A boorish and xenophobic mechanic.
And Christian sees this and says, this isn't right either, and he plots to do something even worse to this guy. And that's pretty much the flavor of the film. I thought the kids were the most incredible actors. I really do. They were so natural, and the emotion that they carried, both in showing no emotion, just being brooding, and particularly Christian, and then being really emotional, they did that so well, and I don't think they got nearly enough credit for it.
Right, and the way that family dynamics can overflow and enter into who these adults, who these young people become as adults, and I think that was very poignant, and the addressing things like depression and suicide and grief specifically,
yes,
and tragedy in their upbringing and contrasting that to what is going on in the developing world and our benevolent helping and so forth in this refugee work, and the parallels there ensue, and we see the relationship between the different families and so forth.
I gotta say that parallel to the work with the people in Africa that Elias's dad is doing. I don't know if he goes there every weekend or goes there for 6 months at a time. It wasn't really clear. I thought that felt a little stilted. It felt like, okay, here's an obvious parallel. The horrors that go on in this unnamed African country and the unfairness that goes on back home in Denmark. I think we could have gotten that message without that part. And I think the African story would have been its own story, too.
I was just going to say that could have been its own study, like someone who is helping and making order out of the chaos in a refugee situation who himself has trouble at home,
mm-hmm.
I think would be an incredible, like a very strong story on its own. Integrating it into this, it gets passed over and does seem really convenient in the overall allegory. But, basically, Christian builds several pipe bombs out of old fireworks and tries to blow up this mechanic.
Let's leave it there, because I really want to recommend this film to people. And you can see it. It's on Amazon Prime. Very easy to see all these foreign films. I think it's pretty amazing.
See what happens.
In a Better World. That's the title that we get, right?
Yeah.
Danish film in 2010. Okay, so now we move to the domestic film, and what, pray tell, is the title of that?
Oh, wow. You're going to be excited for this.
I just saw it.
This is...
Oh, boy.
The King's Speech.
Are you making fun of his stammer?
Well, a little bit.
That's what the film is about.
That's what it's about. Yeah. No, it's in the style of... it's a homage. A tribute.
Did you know that Queen Elizabeth's dad, when he was king, had this terrible stammer? His brother had abdicated because he was hanging out with a divorced woman, and apparently that's enough to do that. He became king, and it was right when World War II was getting started up, that he had to give this big speech, and he had to give a bunch of speeches, actually, but he couldn't enunciate well. So he goes to this speech teacher, I guess, or somebody who deals with speech impediments, and you'd think that wouldn't be enough for a two-hour movie. It was, and more. It was fascinating. The characterization, I thought, was really well done and made you want to keep watching.
Yeah, and I love it. In seeing it again, I didn't know. I did see this when it came out, and I saw more about his speech instructor, Lionel, who very much is like... the doctor in My Fair Lady.
Okay. Dr. Doolittle. No,
Iggins,
wait, that's...
Iggins.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Henry Iggins.
Uh-huh.
And there is a lot of, I think, aspects of this that share that, because it's a speech instructor, but of course this, being the royal family, it has a much different tone. There's some interesting surprise scenes upon introductions, but him being Australian, I think, is really interesting.
Who's Australian?
Lionel.
The doctor, okay.
Yeah, his class and him being a speech instructor, understanding his own place,
right,
because his diction and speech is the way it is. So people who know in British society, no, he is not from there and will never be passable.
Right.
But other people... who do not know and don't understand, I forget what the speech training is called. Elocution?
Yeah, elocution.
Elocution.
Yeah.
And electrocution. so he, that is fascinating to me, because I didn't see that when I was younger.
I'm curious about a few things. There are a couple of tricks. First of all, people who stammer, if they sing to the sound, you know, the melody of a particular song.
Oh, yeah, his technique.
That you don't stammer. I don't know if that's true, but it was true here. Or at one point, the doctor asked him to read something that he said he wasn't able to read, and then he started playing music really loudly, and the guy wasn't aware that he wasn't stammering when he was reading because he was competing with the music. But when he heard a recording of what he had actually said, he found that he wasn't stammering. Things like that seemed to work, and they built up his trust. But the thing is, to enjoy this film, you have to put aside whatever feelings you might have towards the royal family and towards a monarchy system or whatever, and just try and appreciate it for what it is and what it was at that particular time when the country was going to war with Germany. It's a story that I'd never heard before this film and was a big deal.
I think this is a precursor to where the Crown series has come from. I think I find a lot of parallels there, specifically with the vehicles and the technology. I find the microphone and wireless installations and the replication of
the technology. Yeah, it was
BBC stuff.
It was portrayed so well.
Very accurate. The telephone systems, wireless, the aesthetic for the microphone. It's like a giant space age thing in several of the early shots. I mean, it is retro-futuristic, and you realize this is the emergence of broadcast technology, and so everything is designed to be just completely, like, a very durable engineering and so forth.
The interesting thing is that for this particular king, with this particular affliction, the RNA was biting because prior to him, there was no radio, so you didn't have to address the entire world live. And after him, you know, years later, you could pre-record it and edit things, so you wouldn't have to worry about the live presentation. We just saw the Queen's message this past Christmas, and that was obviously edited. So he didn't have that luxury, so it was particularly hard for him.
Surely, yeah, they cover a lot of, I mean, if she was speaking the entire time, you, without video clips, it wouldn't show as much depth. There's much more in the sort of rich, deeper media we have now. But at the time, you see, like, what the BBC took, like, to get their sound. You see this announcer getting ready to announce one of the first speeches.
Oh, yes.
That goes horribly at, like, a racetrack, or no, it's with the army. Or something like that, and the studio and the everything that creates the sound and the care with which the announcer takes care of himself and his poise.
Well, he's perfect.
It's totally different.
He holds two fists in front of the microphone.
Right, they're measuring. They're doing all of this placement.
He does all kinds of word like pronunciation practice.
Yep, diction exercises, breathing, all of that, and in preparation of just giving like the hourly news brief, and it has this air of consistency and ritual that the king cannot produce. Mm-hmm. Not only that, just because it's so complex and these people are so take their profession so seriously, but because of this particular impediment, so he's so much uphill and to work against. But throughout the film, you're rooting for him, and you do see results. So it's a great film to see if you're interested in history and sort of a biopic.
The King's Speech, highly recommended from both of us. And that's, I guess, both films highly recommended here on Films of the Year That Was. Turn that off until next week. But this leads me to something else. We mentioned we saw Queen Elizabeth give the speech. It was on television. She's old. She's been around a long time. She's the longest reigning monarch, I think, in the history of the world.
Act like you know.
Her dad died young. He was only 56 when he died. But she's in her mid-90s now and still going. But she's not going to last forever. I think we all know that. And when that time comes, there are a bunch of things that are going to happen. I want to go over some of those things so that we're ready for them. It's going to be called... Operation London Bridge. Yeah, that is what they will refer to it as when she passes away. So there will be code words. According to this in-depth investigation from The Guardian, after receiving the news from the Queen's doctor, the Queen's private secretary will call the Prime Minister and say, London Bridge is down. Yeah. That's what they're going to say. London Bridge is down. Well, I don't know why they can't just say the Queen just died. And why can't you say that? Why do you have to be all James Bondish? Okay, so then Britain's Foreign Office will call the 15 governments where the Queen is head of state. That might have changed since this was written, too. I don't know if Bermuda is still considered that. And the 36 nations in the Commonwealth, an association of independent former colonies where she remains a symbolic figurehead, to let them know the sad news. People will find out in ways both modern and ancient. All press outlets will be informed at once with a news release at the same exact moment. And in keeping with tradition, a footman in mourning clothing will post a black-edged notice to the gates of Buckingham Palace. And at the same time, the royal family's official website will show the announcement on its homepage. All of this needs to fall into place precisely so that no false info gets out. This actually happened when the press passed around the rumor that the Queen's husband, Prince Philip, had died before he actually did. And the press have their own plans as far as how they're going to announce this. They have all sorts of things lined up. But the bells, this is the interesting part, the bells are going to toll in a muffled sense. Westminster's bells will be muffled. The famous tenor bell at Westminster Abbey, that will be heard throughout the course of the period of mourning. Sporting events will be canceled. Businesses, theaters, and other outlets will probably close down. And there will be a 10-day period of mourning before the funeral. Parliament will convene. The Queen is officially head of state, so the government will also be involved. And at the moment of her death, Prince Charles will become king. That's right. To ensure a smooth transition, all members of Parliament will gather to swear allegiance to the new monarch.
That means they curse him out.
I don't know about that. but yeah, and the thing is, he has been waiting since I think he was three years old to become king. That's when he was next in line.
He's going to be super jaded, though.
Well, I mean, he's been waiting an awfully long time.
Okay, whatever. Yeah.
His son is going to be the king. You know, Prince William will become king, but it's widely thought that he'll become king first, at least for a little while, before either...
For stability.
Yeah. Now, if the queen doesn't die in her palace, let's say she dies while abroad, a plane from the Royal Air Force will send a coffin with royal undertakers to bring her back by air. Now, if she dies in England, but outside of London, like in a private estate, Sandringham House in Norfolk, a car will transport her body to Buckingham Palace, where she will be placed in the throne room and watched over by four of the Grenadier Guards. Those are the ones with the red coats and the big hats. If she is at Balmoral, this is complicated, because that's in Scotland, and she spends every summer there. Scottish rituals then take over. She would be moved to Holyrood House in Edinburgh, then be carried up the city's Royal Mile to St. Giles Cathedral for a service before being placed on the Royal Train to London. Yes, the Royal Train to London.
We've been on that track, I bet.
Not that train, though. That train sits idly by.
That track.
Is waiting, yes. Her subjects will likely wait along the route to throw flowers and pay their respects as the train passes by. There's a whole lot of other things, too. But, you know, the thing that no one mentions that I think is really kind of interesting, as of that moment, you know the song, God Save the Queen? It becomes God Save the King. Yeah, the song changes. You can't sing that anymore because there's no queen. There's only a king. So God Save the King. And I don't know about the money. I don't know, do they just start reprinting pound notes with King Charles?
What's a gender-neutral monarch?
And also, that's the future. Also, he might choose a different name, although it's likely he'll keep this name. But you can choose your name. It doesn't have to be the name that you have as you're living out your life. So he could just pick somebody else and say, I want to be Henry the 20th or something.
Or King Baloney.
I looked all this up because the King's Speech inspired me to learn a little more about this. And I was just curious, what's going to happen?
Yeah.
And it will happen. It will happen probably, well, I don't want to say sooner rather than later, but definitely in the next few years, if not sooner.
What are you doing?
She's like 98. Come on. How much longer can this go on for?
All right. Well, it can go longer.
I don't mean it like people are living through hell. It's just, you know, it's unusual.
I think she has to colonize death first.
Okay. All right. Wow. Okay. That's going to be it for us tonight as we insult monarchists all over the world.
Well, she doesn't give a damn about me, so I'll say what I want.
She doesn't give a damn about a lot of things. That's for sure. I like her, you know. She was,
oh, I like her too.
She was mean to Diana. I didn't like her then, but I like her now.
Absolutely.
I won't like Charles, but I'll probably grow to like him too.
Gosh.
And I don't like William. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter at all. None of this matters. That's the thing you have to keep telling yourself. It doesn't matter, but it's fun to watch.
It's a bit passe.
Yeah. Fake British things are always fun. So with that, let's hear the Ruddles. Write to us, otw@2600.com. Good night.
Bye-bye.
I grew up in the country, beside a chicken shack. So I left for the city, and I didn't look back. Now I'm living in hope, living in hope, living in hope, living in hope. Yes, I'm living. Our friendly
godforsaken town. Nobody stopped to lend a hand, unless they want to put you down. Pocket, nowhere to go.